Hello and welcome to this episode of the Anna Asks podcast. Today I am joined by Sharon Stolia, who is a midwife, a mother, a researcher, and also author of the book Scars of Gold. Scars of Gold is her first book, which details her traumatic birth experience and the long-term impact it has had on her life. Her birth experience was the catalyst for undertaking a PhD, researching the personal childbearing experiences of women, particularly women who are midwives. Sharon has qualifications in nursing, midwifery, public health on a national and international level. She has a great passion about all things maternal health and is slowly working on a passion project focused on raising awareness of birth trauma. She lives in Sydney, Australia with her family, and I'm very pleased to have her on the podcast today. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Anna. Thanks for having me today.
No, thank you so much for joining me. I have read your book, Scars of Gold, and I think the little tagline that you put on your website here, from victim to survivor to warrior of change, is a really powerful progression. And I can see how that has taken shape through the snapshot lens of your book here.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, it's been quite a long journey to get to that stage of feeling that way, but I'm glad I'm finally there, maybe a decade later.
Yeah. Before we kick off with our interview, I just want to acknowledge that we are both here on Aboriginal lands. All the lands of Australia always was, always will be Aboriginal land. Sharon, I've given you the very briefest introduction, but I'd love to hear from you what you have to say about yourself and how you have come to do the work that you do, both as an academic and as an advocate and activist in the space of birth.
Wow, it makes me sound so professional when you speak about me like that. I suppose this all started off from my own experience, really, as you know, Anna. My journey into motherhood wasn't what I expected and hoped it would have been after developing an undiagnosed compartment syndrome just hours after I had my son by an emergency cesarean. And that threw a spanner in the works in terms of my plans that I had, which was to push him out, go home after 4 hours and get on with motherhood. But it didn't quite, didn't go like that. 15 days later and a lot of psychological trauma that I didn't really admit to myself for years had a massive impact on my life, my family, my marriage, my career. So after a few years, I had been sharing a lot about my story on Facebook, I suppose, updates, even when I was in hospital for those 15 days. Because I'm a midwife, I had quite a few friends and colleagues who were also midwives and obstetricians. And after I had shared, over the years, I had quite a few friends and colleagues reach out to me and share some very personal stories of going through similar experiences, not in terms of what happened to my leg, but in terms of not being listened to, falling through the cracks of maternity care because their midwives or obstetricians had this feeling that they were expected to know what to do and how to care for themselves, and leaving feeling traumatized, walking into that journey of motherhood traumatized. And they were all different circumstances, but at the end of the day, it was the same thing. If do you know what I mean? Like the same overarching issue here of being let down by the maternity care services that they had worked for. And that really, like, I felt it tug at my heart here, that here are these women that had experienced such deep wounds and they were struggling, and there really wasn't a voice there. There wasn't a platform there for them to have their voice heard and their experiences acknowledged. I'm talking about midwives as maternity care providers. And we do a lot. We have research out there on women's experiences in general. But we forget, I suppose, that a lot of midwives, like, first of all, in Australia, the majority of maternity care providers, I suppose, in hospitals are female. They're women who have either given birth or are of childbearing age, and they're going to go through this. So it really tugged at me to do something, and I didn't know what, but somehow I just I'd always wanted to do a PhD, I suppose, after having done two masters, and I really like studying and learning. So I, you know, got myself into that, and I thought this is a topic that's very close to my heart, obviously. And I got in touch with some supervisors, and that's how I got into that research. And 7 years later, I'm still doing it because it's a grueling process. Yeah, so that's pretty much how I got into this research space, into researching midwives' personal experiences of childbirth. But in terms of my book, you know, as you know, that's my own journey, my own experience. And I had been writing throughout the years. I'd been writing. So I gave birth in the hospital that I trained at to become a midwife. And one of those days that I was in hospital, the educator, the midwifery educator, came to visit me, and she said, write it down, write it all down. She kind of whispered it. And I was a little bit thinking, like, what, you want me to write this down too? Like, I can't even get up. But it just, I don't know, it just stuck with me. And she had been, during my year as a student, that's what she would always say, write it down, write it down. So I got into this habit of documenting everything, anything and everything. And I started writing it down, my thoughts, my feelings, and emails, letters, journal entries. And I suppose over the course of close to 10 years, I had so much written down. One day my dad said, you should write a book. And that got me into putting all these pieces of writing together into a manuscript for a book. So before I knew it, it was a full book and ready to go.
Because the writing it all down, in the first instance, did you perceive that to be a case of like that instruction or suggestion from the educator as you're not being cared for adequately, I think you should be writing this down? Or did you perceive it differently to that at the time?
At the time, I'll honestly say no, I didn't think I was being, that there was something wrong going on here. Because I mean, look, I did have some friends, obstetricians, midwives, who did write comments to me on Facebook, they're not doing the right thing, you're not getting treated like you should be, you're not getting the right care, or just messages along those lines, because I was updating daily. People were asking me what's going on. You know, 15 days in hospital is huge after having a totally
low. Yeah, because you expect to come home with a baby within you know, maximum 5 days. 15 says something's going on, and in your case it was, and it was quite like it was life-threatening.
Yeah, it could have got life-threatening if it progressed any further. But I mean, I'm lucky to be alive. I'm very lucky to have both legs. I don't take that for granted at all. But I didn't for one second think or feel that I wasn't getting the best care. In fact, I was looking through some of my old Facebook posts, because I saved all of them, and I was defending the hospital. I was defending the care. I was saying, no, I'm getting the best treatment possible. I'm one of them. I'm one of the staff members of the maternity care system. I give care. So I'm in really good hands. And that was genuinely how I felt. It never dawned on me that I didn't receive the care that I should have received as a birthing woman.
But you ended up going through the process of making eventual, you had meetings, complaints, a very extensive process, which is documented in your book. And I think we should say, I know what you're speaking about in relation to, you've mentioned both compartment syndrome, you're lucky to have both legs, but that is sort of the backstory in the book that we haven't necessarily touched on in the interview. Would you mind giving us a little paragraph explanation as to what compartment syndrome is and why you say that you're lucky to have both legs as we are speaking right now?
Yeah. So compartment syndrome, acute compartment syndrome, is an extremely rare condition. None of the doctors who were looking after me had ever seen it in the context of obstetrics, in maternity care. they see it in emergency, they see it in patients who've had trauma or fractures of the leg or a limb, but in maternity care, it's extremely rare. One of the doctors who did come to see me early on, the neurologist, suggested that it could be compartment syndrome and to have an MRI, but a different team, the surgical team later said, no, it can't possibly be because we've never seen it in obstetrics. So it's not compartment syndrome. It must be cellulitis. And cellulitis is an infection of the skin, raging red skin. My leg was, I have brown skin and my leg was shiny red. You could see the redness on my skin. So they treated me with all these different super strong antibiotics, which didn't fix anything. And basically the symptoms are similar, but in my case the leg was so swollen, my right leg, and my foot had dropped and I couldn't move, I couldn't touch my leg. It was the most agonizing pain at the time when it was most acute. They did give me some morphine at that time, and morphine didn't touch the pain at all. And somewhere in the back of my head, as a nurse, I'm thinking this should work. 15, 20 minutes, it should work. But you know, when you're in that moment of agonizing pain, it's very hard to think clinically. And I was crying in pain, I remember, and I couldn't articulate what my mind was telling me. And 50 minutes later, I'm still crying and still saying it's not working. And the doctors had said, give it more time to work. And I suppose by that time I was so powerless. I was just in pain. There's nothing I could do. And then I must have passed out. And from then on, slowly, slowly, the swelling started to go down. But that's pretty much what had happened. But even after I was discharged home, I still hadn't thought of that they had done the wrong thing, or that they hadn't done what they should have done, I should say.
Because if the compartment syndrome is identified, then there's a procedure that they can do immediately to prevent any potential nerve damage.
That's right.
Which is something that you didn't get that procedure, and the nerve issues have been ongoing for you.
That's right. It's a procedure called a fasciotomy, where they cut into the glad wrap kind of structure that holds all the compartments of the muscle together, and it just releases the pressure that's inside. But if you don't do that, what happens is the pressure builds up, builds and builds and builds, and it can actually occlude the blood flow and crush your nerves, and the muscles will die from being crushed so much and not having oxygen. So in a nutshell, that is what happened to me. Thankfully, my artery didn't get crushed, but the nerves and the muscles pretty much died. I liked it. The way I think of it is it's almost like a heart attack in the leg, in the muscle. What happens in a heart attack? I'm not a doctor, but that's how I've understood it. So the nerve running from my knee to my big toe is completely dead. It doesn't work. I can't lift my big toe up. I had foot drop for quite a while. And the anterior, the muscle in just behind the shin, the muscle next to the shin bone, is also dead. So it's now become scar tissue. So when I was seen following discharge by a neurologist, I was told I must have had age on my side. I was 26. I was young. I had great peripheral circulation to keep my leg alive. So with acute compartment syndrome, if you don't have the fasciotomy very quickly after it's diagnosed, it could result in needing to have an amputation. You could lose your limb. It's a limb-threatening condition. So it requires urgent treatment. It requires, I guess, doctors to be able to identify it quickly and get you into surgery. So that didn't happen for me. And that's why the fact that I didn't lose a leg, I consider myself extremely fortunate and blessed.
So this sounds very, very intense, very traumatic and painful in itself. But in all of this conversation, we have sort of sidestepped the fact that you actually had a newborn during this period as well. Mm. And now not only did the newborn need full-time care, but essentially you did too. At what point did you start thinking something's not right here, and looking into perhaps your medical records and what happened?
Good question. I remember, so in terms of me needing care, my parents drove my then husband and I and my baby Jeremy home to our apartment, and I had a walking frame and a foot drop splint, and I could not stand on my own, let alone carry a baby. And that day my parents in our apartment said, "We can't leave you here," because my husband at the time was doing night shifts, and how was this going to happen? And they said, why don't we take you to our place for a little while until you get better? So we went, and it was only meant to be a couple of weeks. Eventually it turned into 4 years, because that's how bad it was. I remember after a few weeks, and because I went home discharged with a course of oral antibiotics, and that was supposed to take away the redness, because everyone was telling me it was cellulitis. So that's what I had thought. Okay, it should get better. And my leg wasn't getting any better. It was still red and still a bit warm to touch. And I went to my first follow-up outpatient visit at the orthopedic clinic, because in the hospital, when they actually admitted it had been compartment syndrome, that when the orthopedic team saw me in hospital, they said it was an undiagnosed compartment syndrome. That's why I was being followed up by the orthopedic team after discharge. And I remember telling him, "I'm on the antibiotics for the cellulitis." And the doctor said to me, "You don't need to be on those antibiotics, because it wasn't cellulitis. You've never had cellulitis. It was compartment syndrome." So because I was also asking him, like, how long do I need to be on this? I was very concerned about the impact this was having on my baby through the breast milk, because from the time he was born, he had running stools because the antibiotics were going through to him. And he said, "No, just stop them now. It was definitely not cellulitis. Otherwise, these high dose antibodies would have fixed it straight away." And that got me thinking, oh, you're right. You know, with all your new baby hormones, you just cannot think properly, right? Let alone like a clinician. And I went home and it was just bothering me. And my dad's GP had also mentioned something to him, saying, "Your daughter's symptoms definitely sounds like it was compartment syndrome." And I started reading about it and was quite horrified that the fasciotomy hadn't been done for me. And I remember posting something, and a friend of mine, an obstetrician, said, "Sharon, you better get your medical records before they mysteriously disappear," in quotes. And that was it. I made a phone call to the hospital and got my medical records.
How interesting that just happens enough that somebody's warning you about it.
Yeah, and that's right. And remember, like, I was frustrated. I was sad at the time. I couldn't carry my baby. I couldn't do all these co-sleeping that I desperately had wanted to do. Remember, I was a night shift postnatal midwife. And I really loved, you know, pacing the corridors with babies in my arms and putting other women's babies to sleep, and I wasn't able to do that for my own. So I was also sad and starting to get a bit angry at my situation, but not necessarily at the hospital just yet, until these little comments were made to me. And then that got me on the journey of getting my records and really reading through it and analyzing what had happened. And as you know, each entry I read just made my blood boiled, just seeing how shocking the care was. How, I'm not talking about my birth, let me just say that now, my pregnancy and birth, like, until I got to the postnatal ward, was 150%. I had the best care. I had a beautiful MGP midwife, and you know, everything was fine until that postnatal experience in the ward. So reading through that just angered me, and that's when I started this battle, this huge battle that took a good 4 years to get what I wanted from the hospital.
Mm. during that 4-year period, who were some of the key allies on your team? Because I think that's something you've mentioned, that one of the first steps is getting your medical record, and you do have a resource available on your website about how people can start to make the process of writing a letter of complaint and that begin to a maternity service, and that begins with getting your medical records, and you have a template on how to request that. But who did you feel was on your side during that time?
After requesting the records and getting a copy, I made a call to the patient representative. I called the hospital, the main switch line, and I said, I want to talk to someone about my hospital care and I'm not happy with it. And that's when they put me through to the patient rep. And then I was put on the line to, in the book, I call her Elizabeth. Remember, the first thing she said was, oh, you're the lady who had the compartment syndrome lady, or something along those lines. And that gave me another clue. Oh, how does she know about me? What's going on? So why did the patient rep who deals with all the hospital complaints already know about me? That was another little alarm bell that went off in my head. And so I was telling her my story, and she, I was surprised because she was an employee of the hospital, but she actually was my biggest ally. She was my biggest support, my biggest advocate in terms of this battle I had with the hospital, because her job really is to advocate for the patients and give them a voice, especially when they're not happy with the care they received. And she was the one that told me what to do. She said, I want you to write a letter of complaint and send it to my email. She was very, very upset for me. I could hear that she was genuine in what she was saying and how she felt about what I had gone through and the care I had received. So she got me on that journey of starting to write the letter. She was the one that I would always call when I had questions or wanted to do something or wasn't happy with something that had gone on.
I think a lot of people just wouldn't even know that there is such a person that they can contact that understands the hospital system, is attached to the hospital, but is actually on your side.
Yeah.
And perhaps that's not a person like Elizabeth is not going to be at every hospital. Perhaps their job title is, but maybe not someone as supportive as her.
Yeah.
But I think that's really a good thing to know, that there is that as the first port of call before you start exploring legal avenues, for example, which is something that in the end you did have to do.
I'll just mention there's some of the different titles in different jobs. So in this hospital, it was the patient, it's called the patient representative. I had actually, when I went back to work, I worked in Elizabeth's actual role in a different hospital, doing the same thing in a different hospital. And there it was called the patient safety and quality unit. Other hospitals have patient safety, patient liaison officer. So lots of different names, but you are trying to go through that avenue, I would just recommend calling the hospital first and asking them for the name and number of whoever it is that you make a complaint to or write a letter to that, and they will give you those details.
What was it like being on the other side of the fence when you did start working in the patient safety and quality unit at another hospital? Because part of what was the one of the ongoing consequences was that you were no longer able to practice as a midwife, which was quite a source of upset and grief in itself, is what I'm gathering from what you've written in the book.
Yeah, it was a real source of grief, and I never thought that I would feel so strongly about the job that I'd been doing. I mean, I won't lie to you, at times it felt like a thankless job when you're working exhaustingly long hours and not able to go to the toilet and you know, shift work, the impact of that and just on your feet all the time. But I loved that job. I always got this joy out of helping new mothers get breastfeeding and help in teaching, showing the dads how to change a nappy for the first time. And I got so much joy out of that. And I suppose I didn't realize how much I loved it until I couldn't do it anymore. And I couldn't do it because I couldn't be on my feet. And at that time I was still falling over quite a lot and very unstable. And by the time I went back to work, I had already had another surgery on my foot. So because I had been employed permanently in that hospital, not the place where I'd had the baby, in a different hospital, they legally had to give me some work to do. So they put me in this management position as a patient safety and quality officer for the critical care streams. And I had no idea what I was doing, but I learned it very quickly. And it was a desk job, and it was looking through all the complaints that come through the hospital, triaging them, I suppose, and like categorizing what it required, whether it was a letter, whether it was a meeting, whether I had to get the doctors involved to follow up, write a letter back, or more education and training was to be implemented for whoever was involved, whether it needed a full-scale investigation, and depending on the severity of like the contents of these letters of complaints, you know, it would either be that, or it was something that came through the HCCC, the Healthcare Complaints Commission, which is the body for complaining for New South Wales, and each state has their own one. Yeah, that was a big eye-opener for me, because I was dealing with seeing letters from people who were pissed off at the care they received. And I felt so much empathy for them, because I was still in that process with my issue, right, with the hospital that I'd given birth at. And seeing how things were handled was just heartbreaking. And I talk a little bit more about it in the book, without naming any hospital names, but just seeing just the way things are handled with, you know, not as much openness and transparency as it should be, infuriated me. And I just saw in these letters, often these patients just wanted an acknowledgement of what had gone wrong, and just if there was a mistake, just a sorry. I'm sorry this happened to you. I'm sorry you're living with this still. And that's all, generally speaking, most of the people wanted. But and then I saw from an organizational point of view in these offices, which was not direct patient care. We're looking at administration, we're looking at legal things, we're looking at protecting the hospital from litigation. Often I would see doctors would write beautiful letters of apology and, you know, sympathy for what had happened. And then these letters would be shredded to bits, and I would see almost like big cover-ups, like, I don't like to use that word, but just dulled down and all that empathy taken away from these letters. And it was just completely defensive, and it made me so angry. And I thought, is this what's happening to me? Because at that stage, I had several letters back and forth between me and the hospital, and the letters I received would just infuriate me. I'm thinking, you're not getting it. You're not getting what I want. I'm saying this, but you're not even acknowledging what I'm saying in this letter. Are you still not listening to me? I wasn't heard in hospital. I'm not being heard here. And I was so frustrated and just thinking, how do I get myself heard when this whole system is against me? And I felt so betrayed, so let down, because I was part of the system. I'd given care in this system. And now I just felt like powerless. Right. So that experience of being there, and I remember sharing my story with one of my colleagues in the office at the time. And I said this, I don't know what to do. Like, this is what's happened. And he said, why don't you write to the HCCC? I mean, I said, why? He goes, because they have to investigate if you write to the HCCC. If you write it in the way that you know it needs to be written, because I'd been dealing with these letters, like I had learned how to write things that couldn't be ignored, because there's a way to write it. There's a way to write it where the hospital can't ignore it. And I said, of course, that makes sense. So that's what started me on this massive 18-page letter where I I spend a lot of time on it, but I went through every entry in my medical records and I questioned. I said, I had this table, this date, this time, this person wrote this. And then in the next column, I wrote, that breaches the policy for management of X, Y, or Z, because I pulled up policy directives and local policies and protocols for that hospital at the time. And I cross-matched my care with what should have happened. And I asked the question, why was this not done? Why was I not transferred to the tertiary referral hospital? Because you did not have a vascular team. I was told that I should be seen by vascular, but I wasn't. Why didn't you send me here? That's what I did. And that's how I finally started to get some answers.
Massive, massive process, and something that takes a lot of dedication and, to be honest, a lot of skill. And people who don't have a clinical background may be sitting there thinking, well, how am I going to do that? And that's where you need to be getting some additional support on your side to even be able to decipher the medical records for a start, let alone go looking for the policies. And that's something that's also discussed in your e-guide of how to find those people. Those people might be GPs, independent or privately practicing midwives who can sit down and go through that kind of stuff with you. But I'll link to that resource in the show notes here.
It's about finding your voice, and it's about, I don't know if it came out in my book, my whole point is you do have a voice. Mm. Even if you're just one, you do have a voice. Like, that's what I want them to say. And you need to use it, because that's the only way we'll affect change, right?
Yeah. And you have been able to affect change in some quite meaningful ways as well. Would you like to discuss your involvement with writing up your own case study?
Yeah, that was a huge win for me. So when I did go through the HCCC and finally had another meeting with the hospital, with the HCCC present, they couldn't ignore my letter. And they just said, yes, you're right, Sharon, we stuffed up. This shouldn't have happened. This just should not have happened. And you know what? We're sorry. And that was a moment that I could, something happened for me. And I thought, I need to do something, because I went into that meeting and I knew what I wanted. And what I'd wanted was to have my case report written up, because they kept, my whole reason for that was everyone kept telling me, so rare, so rare, so rare in obstetrics. But I'd been doing my own side research into the journal, into the medical literature, and I had found 15 other cases in obstetrics around the world where this had happened. And I'd found one or two in legal case files where this had happened to women and then they had successfully sued, not in Australia, in the United States. But that told me that there is a need for awareness of this condition, however rare it might be. There is a need for awareness in doctors and midwives. And this is what I wanted them to do. And so when they asked me in that meeting, what do you want? I said, I want my case report written up. That's it. And I explained to them why I wanted it. And then to my great relief, they said, okay, we'll do it. So I went away from that meeting feeling really amazing and just kind of in a state of shock too. It turned out that the doctor who had written that report didn't want me involved in it, because when I did speak to them initially, I said, I wanted to be part of that report. I wanted to give the patient perspective in that report, because there's a journal I found which allows for that to give like a human element to a case. And I thought it was really important, because we see in hospitals, patients become bed numbers. They become rare and interesting cases for teaching. But those cases are people who have lives, who have to live with that condition every day and whatever it is. Now, these doctors, midwives, nurses, they see these interesting cases, they go home to their families, they come back for work the next day, and it's a whole new set of patients or women. And they forget about that interesting case that you will forever be referred to as. And I just wanted the human side of it in this paper. And that was my goal the whole time. And when a few months later, I was told that the doctor who wrote up the case report didn't want me involved, so she just stopped writing it completely. And I told Elizabeth, Like, I was so angry when I heard that. I thought, how many hurdles do I need to go through to just get something positive out of this? And I said, let me write it. And she thought I was joking, I think. And when she realized I was serious, she went to the director of medical services and he called me into his office, which was also something that never happens. And he said, how can I help you? How can he saw it? He's a beautiful man. He saw it as a missed opportunity for education. It didn't matter that it was a stuff up in their hospital. He thought, if we don't write this up, this is a missed opportunity. We need to do it. He didn't care that it would make the hospital look bad, I suppose, because all the case reports out there are cases of successfully identifying the compartment syndrome and doing the surgery, right? There wasn't any cases out there, written cases, published cases of what an undiagnosed one where it didn't happen, like the surgery didn't happen as it should have. And he said, look, I'll support you. If you need a name to put on it, I'll put my name, but let's ask the other doctors first. So I went along my went back home and I started writing. I just wrote. I you know, researched the other case reports. I put it together. I grouped the symptoms. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I just wrote this journal article. Like a timeline of what happened in my case. And I attached that. And eventually it got accepted for publication and it got published. It was a massive win for me. It was huge. Because for me, all I wanted was to know that if there's another woman somewhere out there, here in Australia or on the other side of the world, who's got these same symptoms and someone's and a doctor doesn't know what it is, they can just do a quick Google search, compartment syndrome and obstetrics, and my case report comes up. And then just to raise awareness that there is a possibility, and if it is, you need to act quickly. That's all I wanted. That's literally all I wanted, so that someone else doesn't have to go through what I went through, because they're umming and ahhing, is it, isn't it, because we've never seen it. You know, so it can't possibly be, because the next woman might not be so lucky. She might lose a leg. She might not have the amazing family support that I had. She might not have parents, you know, who can take them all in and literally look after a brand new baby, new grandparents. You know, they were well into their 50s at the time, had four kids, raised kids, and back to having a new baby in their home and their grown adult child, their eldest child, suddenly needing full-time care to go to the toilet. The next woman might not be as fortunate. She might be an immigrant who can't speak the language. I didn't want anyone else to go through that if it could possibly be avoided. That's all I wanted in my case report, and I ended up getting it. But it was a big fight, big fight, and very long, and, you know, roller coaster of emotions. But I just want to say, I had one of my best friends who I've known, you know, gone to school with since I was 12 years old. She's a lawyer and she supported me through the whole thing. She is Lily in the book, and I don't give her as much credit as I should have in the book, but she was the one that kept pushing me to keep writing these letters, keep going. She would take time off her job on days that I had meetings with lawyers, days I had meetings with hospitals, she would take days off work to come with me. And she came with me to that meeting with the ACCC, and she's always been there for me. And she's, you know, she even edited my book before I had it published. So that's a special thanks to her.
She's the kind of friends we need. I wrote something recently that said, the crux of surviving motherhood is other mothers. And I feel like the crux of getting through what you have gone through is perhaps Lily Elizabeth and the family support around you.
Yes, my family. Like, Lily's not a mother yet, but I'll tell you what, she's a fierce advocate. Mm. My parents, my siblings, just incredible. Like, for them, it was all a big upheaval as well, having this whole new Me, my husband, my new baby, one of my brothers giving up his room. They're both sharing a room. I mean, we're talking about growing kids here. Like a baby crying at night. They had to build a demountable at the back in their backyard just to house all of our furniture because there was no point paying rent because when we saw I'm going to be there for months. So we had to move everything out of the apartment we were in into mum and dad's demountable. And you know, it was the middle of summer, new baby. Then they got their whole house with ducted air conditioning. You know, the things that my family sacrificed, it, like I just can't put a value on it. Makes me teary when I talk about it. And I didn't talk a lot about them in the book, but it was them that they got me through it.
We can hear the gratitude in your voice. Yes, grab that tissue. Exactly. Sharon, thank you so much for sharing your story with us in a nutshell. Anybody who's taken an interest in this book or is considering really starting to look into what's happened in their own care, I would really recommend reading Sharon's book, Scars of Gold, heading to her website, getting her guide about the process, how to begin that kind of process. And we won't touch on your research in this interview because it's a secret. Your results, your next round of results are still secret, awaiting to be formally published.
There are two papers out already on the survey. The third paper's in the progress. So if you want to look at midwives' birth choices and outcomes, there is a paper on that and a review on what's already published in that topic.
And there's an excellent episode that you recorded with Pregnancy, Birth and Beyond podcast in August last year, 2022, covering some of that research. It's called When Midwives Give Birth, New Research with Sharon Stolia. So that one's an excellent one. Very interesting finding for me as a home birth mama to see that 26% of the midwives surveyed reported an interest in having a home birth, which is a massively higher rate than the actual rates of home birth in Australia.
That's what they
11%,
wanted.
11% ended up having that kind of birth, which is huge compared to the Australian rate is, I think, 0.4% as a general population.
Huge difference. It speaks volumes for self-advocating, I suppose, as a midwife and navigating the system to get what you want. Knowledge.
And how understanding the system helps to get the care and outcomes that you want. Which is applicable for the topic that we've just covered as well as for navigating pregnancy and birth care itself.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you're right. It is. You really need to know the system to kind of navigate. I just want to say that if there's anyone going thinking of you know, looking into their birth, what happened, or writing a letter of complaint, you need to remember that your voice matters and you do have a voice. And even if it is just one voice, it counts, it matters. And we have to speak up if we've experienced disrespectful maternity care or care that left us broken and traumatized, because it's not okay.
Many individual voices make a chorus, and we know that there needs to be some big change. And I think sometimes you don't see that as a care provider when you're working in the system, perhaps until you're on the other side of it, which is exactly your experience and what your research is drawing out as well.
That's right.
Thank you so much, Sharon. And if you want to catch up with what Sharon is sharing with the world, you can find her on Instagram at Ending Birth Trauma.
Thank you, Anna. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thank you so much for listening. If you love this episode, please consider passing it on to a friend or leaving a rating or review. All these things help people find us and help me to continue to bring you meaningful conversations with spectacular humans. You can find my services and my book, Mama, You're Not Broken, Unmasking the Unspoken Emotions of Modern Motherhood, at my website, www.annacusack.com.au. You can also follow along with me on Instagram at Anna Cusack Postpartum. It is such a joy to bring you this podcast. Please check the show notes for links to the various things we've spoken about and all our guests' contact details, as well as a link to become a podcast sponsor if you're so inclined. Until next time, may the parenting forces be with you.